Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Albert Einstein suggested to raise new questions, new possibilities, to regard old questions from a new angle requires creative imagination and marks real advance. Thomas Edison suggested, the inventor has a logical mind that sees analogies. And Winston Churchill commented, success consists of going from one failure to another without loss of enthusiasm. The mind of an inventor works differently than the mind of a non-inventor. What inspires the inventive mind? What is different in the way an inventive mind perceives the world that is different from other minds? What is the role of an inventor in our society? In this interview, recorded in January of 2005, we visit with Evan Schwartz, author of Juice, the creative fuel that drives world-class inventors. According to Evan Schwartz, the creative energy or juice of inventors gets applied to problems, products, companies, and markers through the use of creative patterns. Invention is a set of strategic thinking strategies that can be learned, taught, and practiced, just as with other skills, cooking, acting, or sailing, for example. Evan Schwartz began our conversation by describing what differentiates an inventive mind from other types of minds.
Well, one thing inventors do, and this is a misconception, they don't just find solutions to problems that we all have. They actually find problems. They find deficiencies in everyday products or things that we do, and they actually think things that we accept are malfunctioning, and they think things are obsolete. For instance, an inventor will think almost opposite in many respects to a consumer. A consumer will think, do I want that? How much does it cost? Will I impress people if I have that? An inventor will think, how did that get here? Can I make that obsolete? How can I improve that?
What would be some examples?
Well, one of the inventors who I interview and spend time with in the book is a guy named Woody Norris, who's in Southern California. And he was looking at the problem of sound. You know, sound comes out of your stereo or your computer, and it fills the room. And he came up with an analogy. You know, we have spotlights. Why don't we have spotlights for sound? So we came up with a way of using ultrasound waves to create distortion in the air so I could send a beam of sound to your head, and you're the only person who hears it in the room. So he created a new opportunity and used another invention strategy that I call applying analogies. The spotlight could be an audio spotlight.
And that's the hypersonic sound.
Exactly.
Give us an example, perhaps using that as a way other inventions have now become necessities. An obvious one would be an airplane.
Yeah, there's that old phrase that necessity is the mother of invention. But it's actually a little of both, that invention is the mother of necessity. Very few people saw the need for the telephone or the microwave oven or even something like the iPod when it was completely new. But the inventors of these things created the demand with their fantastic gadgets. So it's really a little of both. The inventors are the people who see that opportunity, and their invention creates the demand for it.
When the demand is created, do you find that there's sometimes an unexpected synergy or an unintended consequence?
Unintended consequences of inventions? Well, that happens all the time. I mean, you could look at the automobile. A fantastic invention, of course, but no one knew that the automobile would create suburbia and strip malls and all kinds of pollution problems and the oil crisis, the immense trade-off society made by accepting the automobile for what it is and not planning on these unintended consequences.
So the planning for those unintended consequences is something that is away from the mind of the inventor, perhaps.
Yeah, the inventor often doesn't see it. In fact, very rarely do they see it. The inventor is pretty much on to the next invention. You know, the inventor, the inventive mind, which you started to talk about early, was, you know, it's really an addiction. If, you know, the reason I use this term juice, the creative juice, is because these chemicals flow through your body when you're inventing. It's adrenaline or dopamine or endorphins, whatever you want to call it. And once an inventor is successful in coming up with a radical new idea, a breakthrough, they want to do it again and again, and they're addicted to this process. And that's really the mind of the inventor. They get out of bed in the morning and say, what can I invent today?
Is that process unique to the brain of the inventor?
We all have this creative energy, and inventors essentially tap into it much better than other people, just by training their brain.
How do we tap into it?
That's, of course, the mysterious question. What distinguishes these inventors? And we've had them throughout history, from Leonardo da Vinci to Samuel Morse to Thomas Edison to the people I interview today. What separates these people? And it's really training their mind. It happens when they're kids. A lot of them spend time taking apart transistor radios or televisions or fixing cars or playing with Lego or dissecting frogs, whatever it was. But it's a physicality. It's getting your mind and your hands working together. And this is probably not going to happen if you're just, for instance, watching TV 8 hours a day. In a lot of ways, our society is anti-invention. So the people who are inventive definitely stand out.
Do you have any of that experience in your childhood?
Somewhat. You know, I used to build some, you know, forts in the backyard, or I have taken apart radios. As a writer, writing has some inventive thinking that has a high overlap with inventors who get patents, for instance. You know, I wouldn't put myself in the category of some of these other people. Although, essentially, the main point of the book, that this creative juice, this creative energy, can be tapped into and channeled for whatever you want to use it for. We have to be a creative society. That's what creates all the jobs in this country. We don't make money from manufacturing or some of those jobs of the past. We are an intellectual property society, a knowledge economy. So invention really sits at the core of it, and we don't look at it enough.
You talk about inventors thinking outside of the box. How is that kind of thinking stimulated in a young person?
It's constantly questioning. For instance, my previous book I wrote about the kid who invented television. The book's called The Last Lone Inventor. Philo T. Farnsworth was a potato farmer. And what he did is constantly read about new developments in radio and electronics. And he essentially came up with some of these key ideas for electronic television when he was a teenager. But he always said, if I had television when I was a kid, I probably wouldn't have invented anything. An inventive person will look at a television and say, you know, how can I make that better? And they'll invent TiVo or something like that. The typical consumer will just watch it and not think in those terms at all. So it's really getting kids to play and experiment. Invention and play are almost synonymous. Invention is all about, can I try this? What if I did this? And that's what it's all about. It's coming up with your own world and playing with Lego, playing with toys, imaginary play. Kids who are good at that are going to be more inventive when they're older.
If we're directing our ideas towards developing the mind of young inventors, you're saying fill their fund of knowledge when this fund begins to develop and make it a toolbox of creative ideas or ways of thinking outside of that toolbox?
Yeah, Barry, that's a good way to put it. It's a toolbox. And I also think, you know, in education we have this whole rush towards standardized testing, and that's very anti-invention.
Describe that. What do you mean?
Well, when you have standardized testing, you're having teachers basically use a standard curriculum and make sure kids know a certain list of facts or a certain list of things that everyone else knows. And that's not the way the world is moving. It's moving towards portfolios, independent projects, or team projects. Inventive thinking is critical to that, because the inventor is the one who moves it forward and sees the problem and creates the project in the first place. Essentially, inventors create their own jobs. That's why invention is so important to combat the outsourcing epidemic. Companies are outsourcing jobs to India and China. The jobs that stay are going to be the ones that are highly creative.
So staying with the idea of creativity, can you talk about the creative patterns of inventors?
In Juice, what I do is break out 11 creativity patterns. And we talked about a couple of them, like applying analogies, the audio spotlight, or creating possibilities, pinpointing problems that no one else sees. These are creativity patterns. Some of them are also in the realm of things that you could apply to almost any job, like embracing failure. One of the inventors who I interviewed is Dean Kamen, who's probably one of the most well-known inventors today. He invented the Segway scooter. And he's always making mistakes as fast as he can. And he did this since he was a kid, creating a machine shop in his parents' basement. And he invented all kinds of medical devices before he invented the Segway. You might have noticed the Segway didn't do too well in the market. Well, he embraced that as a learning experience and created a completely new version called the Centaur, which is this scooter that you could sit down on and still have that same sort of balancing mechanism. So you can't underestimate these people, because there are people in this world who experience a high degree of failure and don't learn anything from it and keep making the same mistake over and over again. And then there are people who integrate failure into their experience, and they don't make the same mistake twice. They make new ones as fast as they can.
So that would be the trial and error method recorded, remembering what the error was.
Exactly. And Edison was famous for this. He said, "I invented 1,000 ways not to make a light bulb." He would go on these incredible journeys, these frenzied all-night sessions to find the right material for the filament of the light bulb. For instance, he and his team would make mistake after mistake after mistake before they hit upon their success.
Evan Schwartz, let's talk more about the inventor's creativity patterns. But first, I want to say that in this edition of Radio Curious, we're talking with Evan Schwartz from his office in Stamford, Connecticut. He's the author of Juice, the creative fuel that drives world-class inventors. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Evan, these creative patterns, that seems to be the most intriguing part of what you've gathered. Do you agree?
Yeah, I think so. All the inventors have their own toolbox, their creativity patterns that they use over and over again. Edison had that. Alexander Graham Bell had that. All the inventors who I talked to today have that. But they're common. And, you know, I list them all on my website. It's gotjuice.org. But, you know, essentially there are 11 of them. One that we haven't talked about is what I call thinking systematically. In other words, one idea is fantastic, but inventions that are successful in the market are systems. If you think of the iPod, it's more than just a little hard drive. It's a system. It's the software that you download. It's the iTunes store where you buy the music. It's a whole system, and you could look at all these inventions from history, like the automobile assembly line was a system of manufacturing, and it is the thing that made automobiles popular and affordable. So you can't underestimate this ability of inventors to pile on one idea after another until they've created a system that attacks a really big problem.
Let's stay with the creativity patterns and see how they fit together. If individually they work, or do you find that a synergy flows from multiple use of those patterns?
Yeah, that's a good point, Barry, because most of these inventors, I'd say all of them, do use more than one. They'll find problems, they'll use things like visualization, which is another pattern, or analogizing, or thinking systematically, and they'll apply three or four of those strategies, and that's how they'll come up with their solution. So you're right, they click together. They're building blocks in a way.
We're staying somewhat in the theoretical or the ethereal concept. Can you bring this to some of the practical inventions that you can tell us about? We've talked about the automobile and the unintended consequences. What are some of the others?
Well, some of the other inventions that I talk about in the book, and one strategy is that they use is detecting barriers. The Wright brothers, for instance, they were bicycle repairmen, and they looked at how bicycles worked, and they applied that to the problem of the aircraft. Everyone else thought the problem was, let's build an engine, a motor, to propel this thing into the air. The Wright brothers thought, no, that's not the problem. The barrier really is in controlling the aircraft, and it's almost like the fine-tuning. In fact, they said it's exactly like the fine-tuning of a bicycle. So they created a fine-tuning mechanism for wing warping, as they called it, for fine-tuning the way the wings were positioned. And once they found that barrier, they were able to overcome it. And there are several inventors who I've met who have that same thing. They find that roadblock that no one else sees. Everyone else is on a different road.
What are some tools that our listeners can put in their toolbox to examine the barriers and find the way around?
Well, it's basically trying to say, everyone else is banging their head against this wall. Let me find a different route. One of the inventors in the book is a guy named Carl Crawford, who invented the spiral CT scanner. You know, CT scanners are one of the amazing medical imaging technologies in the world. The original inventors won the Nobel Prize for it, but they all worked in a certain way, and they came up, Carl Crawford, when he was at General Electric, came up with a new pattern, a new way of using the scanner to look at the body and cut the body in visual patterns that resemble a slinky. And once he was able to come up with the math and the theory of doing that, he created a new type of CT scanner. These are million-dollar machines that hospitals have. And this invention eventually replaced every other CT scanner on the market. So that kind of better mousetrap thinking is extremely valuable. Just because something exists, it doesn't mean it can't be improved.
You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. We're talking with Evan Schwartz, author of Juice, the creative fuel that drives world-class inventors. This interview was recorded in January of 2005. Evan Schwartz, author of Juice, let's talk about applying an invention to the big picture of our society. Where does invention fit into the economic society that we have here in the United States?
Well, we've always been an inventive society. Some of our founding fathers were inventors, like Franklin and Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson actually invented the swivel chair and the dumbwaiter. That's why this was built into the Constitution and why the patent law was one of the first laws that President Washington signed. And so invention has always driven the economy, and that's even truer today. And what we're seeing now is that the education system doesn't quite realize this, and we're focusing on why we're losing so many jobs to outsourcing and so forth, when we should be focusing on how to create new jobs by being much more innovative. And if you just look at any major invention, you know, radio and television, or the telephone, or the airplane, or things today like the iPod. They create entire new industries that employ thousands of people. So we should be fostering invention as one of the central things that we do, and especially in education.
You talk about the concept of the idea of grace. One of the people who you interview says, I got intrigued by how groups of muscles got orchestrated in the brain. They really are like a symphony. A grace is a beautiful thing.
Yeah, and that's Steve Jacobson. He's a robot inventor. He invents robotic arms, and he also invents very playful robots. He's based in his own laboratory in Utah, and he discovered, you know, a lot of principles to replicate how our muscles work, and he developed these amazing robots. Some of them play ping pong with one another. Some of them play air hockey. Some of them juggle. He's also invented robots like at the Universal Theme Park, the giant dinosaur that is one of the feature attractions. So that's also what inventors do. They get inspired by nature, you know, either muscles or how birds fly. Nature can teach us how an invention should work. And there are just many examples of that, and that should definitely be in any creative person's toolbox.
Evan, putting this all together, are there exercises or games that you could suggest to try and think of something that doesn't exist that we can use?
Yeah, to just get a sense of how invention works, just try playing the invention game for yourself. Just think of something that people would need that doesn't now exist or that you would need in your life. It would be something that could make you rich, something that would help people live better, something that would transform your company or your industry. And you'll see if you try to do this, take as much time as you want, that it's not as easy as you think. You know, some of us would think of, you know, an anti-gravity pack that lets us hover above the treetops. Others would think of car keys with chips that let you locate them when they're lost and so forth. But it's a really fun thing to do, to try to play the invention game and take a few days to see if you could come up with something that would be the makings of a great invention.
The one that comes to my mind is applying an analogy. I'd like to see a fax machine that would allow me to fax myself.
That's right, like a teletransportation, like in Star Trek, where you're beamed up to the Enterprise, right?
The closest we've come to it is an airplane.
That's probably true. There have been some science fiction movies about that, and, you know, scientists would probably argue this is not even possible, but it's still a great exercise to go through, to think if you could come up with a way to do it without violating rules of nature, or rules of science. Or sometimes inventors create their own rules, and Einstein did that all the time.
And that's what happened with the airplane. The concept was, we can't fly unless we're a bird, and that rule was violated.
Yeah, and this happens to inventors all the time. They're getting laughed at. They're doing the impossible, and people just don't see it. And this was true of the telegraph. The government didn't want it. The airplane, the government saw no need for it at first. And that's always going to be the case. So inventors shouldn't be discouraged by that in the slightest.
Playing the inventor's game yourself, have you played it, and what have you come up with?
Well, one thing I thought of was the problem of procrastination. You know, a lot of people waste so much time.
Inventing a way not to procrastinate?
Well, I came up with a concept for an anti-procrastination watch. To see how it works, you'd have to read the patent application.
Well, Evan Schwartz, author of Juice, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, can you tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately?
Sure. An interesting book I read recently, actually heard it on tape, is the new Bob Dylan autobiography, Chronicles, Volume 1. And it's read by Sean Penn, and it has a very high overlap. You'll see how his songwriting and his being an artist has high overlap with being an inventor. He uses all kinds of metaphors, and he writes about things he knows about, and especially in his early career. And if you think of things like some of his songs, like A Hard Rain Is Gonna Fall or Blowing in the Wind, these are analogies or metaphors. And he was incredibly inventive. And even in the book, he has an analogy or a metaphor in almost every sentence. So it's a real pleasure to hear it, even though some of it's frustrating because he doesn't tell you much about his songs, at least in this volume.
Evan Schwartz, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious.
Thanks, Barry. It's been a pleasure.
Evan Schwartz is the author of Juice, the creative fuel that drives world-class inventors. The book he recommends is Chronicles Volume 1. That's Bob Dylan's autobiography. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for joining us.